solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as the trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
So I had this simple framework linked to air, fire, water, earth.
Okay.
Air was about, you know, our position in the market, which was about, you know, we want to be market leaders. But fire was about innovation. Like, we want to bring the best ideas to our clients. The latest idea, the next practices, not just the best practices. You know, like, where do we push? So India should be a hub for innovation, where the rest of BCG should say, we want to see how they do it and we want to get inspired, not bring the other way around. So how do we do that? Water was about, ultimately, this is the people business. So how do we, people will go through journeys, they will have moments of truth in their life. How do we adapt to their moments of truth and how do we flow with that? And earth was about giving back to Mother Earth. And in those days, it was about, can we impact 100 million lives in India? So the work we do with education, with health, with rural development, etc. How do we? So I think that was this, it was a simple construct, air, fire, water, earth. We used to start every meeting with that.
Wow.
And what are we doing to move the needle in that? At least all my leadership meetings. And it was a bit like a magnet. It was a bit of a larger calling and a purpose.
Welcome to the next conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. A series of reflective conversations on leadership, transitions, careers, and life. A podcast which brings together a combination of insights from local journeys and global wisdom. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. My why is to help people play to their unique potential through my coaching, podcasting, and writing. You can learn more about my work at www.playtopotential.com. That's PlayToPotential.com. As you might have noticed, we took a little bit of a break from new guests at the podcast for the last few months, as I was tied up with my first book with Penguin, also titled Play to Potential. That's now a national bestseller, I'm really happy to announce. In the book, I lay out the idea of looking at potential in a holistic sense across the various domains of our life, through the pulls and pressures of midlife, and through the various seasons and transitions. Do look it up on Amazon if this piques your curiosity. My guest this time is a very special one. It's a classmate and friend from IMA over the last 28 years, Neeraj Agarwal. I've had the privilege of knowing him and seeing his meteoric rise for the last several years. Neeraj is the chair of the Asia-Pacific region for BCG and a member of BCG's Global Executive Committee. He oversees businesses in Australia, China, India, Japan, South Korea, and Southeast Asia. Prior to this, he led the BCG India office from 2015 to 2018. In the last few years, Neeraj has also been active in setting up Plaksha University, and he chairs its board of trustees. The university seeks to reimagine technology education and undertake transformative research to address grand challenges that the world faces. Recently, just before August 15th of this year, they graduated the first batch, and I'm told to flying colors and to great opportunities and to wonderful organizations that were ready to lap up these graduates. In our conversation, we get into Neeraj's formative years, his evolution at BCG, how he manages his energy, his why behind Plaksha, how AI will impact our futures, principles he would like to pass on to his kids, and much, much more. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Neeraj Agarwal. Neeraj, thank you so much for making the time on the Play to Potential podcast.
My pleasure, buddy.
I know. It's been a long time coming. I don't know if you remember way back around our 20th reunion in Goa, we tried to do it. I think then...
Yeah, you're right. We've been trying it for a bit. But what you've done with this is remarkable. And I've really, really enjoyed listening to them over the years.
Thank you.
And you've taken the game every year to an even better level.
Thank you.
I've told you this many times. Thank you. It's not new
to
you.
And now it's at a high enough level to reach out to.
No. I feel out of place, to be honest.
Actually, sincerely saying this, I think I'm also sort of moving the conversation more towards exploring potential in a holistic sense and sort of talking to people who have a little more of a holistic perspective on life and
given the conversations we've had and my observations of you, Neeraj, I really, apart from the heights you've climbed on the corporate front, I genuinely admire sort of the, if I may say, the multifacetedness of your life, and really would love to explore how you do it and sort of get a peek into the, you know, behind the curtains view of Neeraj.
No, kind of you to say that, but I think what you put out on the flavor aspect in your book really, really resonates.
Right.
And I love the VO part of it.
Yes. Correct. So I think, I feel we're all shaped by the early years, right, Neeraj? I think it'll be useful for us to know just the first 15 years. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up, maybe the family context, parenting context. You know, the 3-4, if I may say, parts of your operating system that got shaped in the first 10, 15 years. It'll be good for us to know.
Yeah, I think probably what I'll draw out is year 6 to year 15.
Mm.
I used to live in the state of Haryana. Mm. My dad was in the Haryana State Electricity Board. And this was the time when greenfield thermal plants were being set up.
Mm-hmm.
So he used to be part of the team which used to set up these greenfield thermal plants. Power was a new thing. This is, I'm talking about late 70s to 80s time period. My father came from his father was a sarpanch in a village. So for him, education was his ticket to, he went to Thapar Engineering College and education was his ticket to, you know, wherever he got to.
Mm.
And I was only child, my father and mother. And my mother also, she grew up in, her father was also an engineer. Her father was an engineer, sorry. And she, you know, his job, he was in CPWD.
Mm.
So his job took him to various parts of the country. She was born in Rajasthan, but my mother in Pushkar because, you know, but lived most of her life in Himachal.
Okay.
I lived most of her, my life in this nondescript place called Asand, which was between Panipat and Jind, where, because these greenfield power plants were set up in places where nobody really lived, government could buy large tracts of land and they were set up there.
It was like a
township.
Township, okay. With a school inside and all.
There was no school. It was, there were 50 kind of white collar workers.
Yeah.
And maybe about, 1,000 blue collar workers kind of stuff. So it was a very small township, that small that the other social infrastructure was very limited in the early 10 years because we went there when the first 10, 20 people were there.
So
we were like literally 0-1 stage. So I used to go to school about half an hour away and later years about 2 hours away.
Wow. And this was English medium or?
Yeah. So that's part of the story. The half an hour away school was English medium only till grade 7.
Hmm.
So once I reached grade 8, I think the choice was to move to Hindi medium or to go to a school which is 2 hours away, going and 2 hours coming.
Wow.
But that's what we did then. And I moved to that school from grade 8 to 10. And that also ran out in 10. And then I went to
grade 8 and grade 10, you were commuting 4 hours a day?
4 hours a day.
Wow. And by state bus? By
a colony bus for half an hour and by a Haryana state bus, Haryana Roadways bus, for an hour and a half.
Wow. Okay. So that was 8 to 10.
That was 8 to 10. And 11th and 12th, like, I moved to Delhi in DPS RK Puram, the hostel. And that exposed me to the big bad or the big good world, you know.
Understood. And was that an obvious choice? Again, I'm curious. I was lucky, given my father's decisions, to be based in the metro for my 8th to 12th. So in a way, the school I went to was like the DPS equivalent in Chennai, you could say. But was DPS an obvious choice given where you were, the 8 to 10? Was that the sort of seen as a ticket to better institutes?
So I evaluated at that time, the choice was you had to find a school with a boarding because my parents lived not in Delhi.
Mm.
And I could go to Chandigarh or Delhi. Mm. And I think Delhi was, my father felt, had a better ecosystem. Mm. And we looked at Mothers International, DPS Mathura Road and DPS RK Puram and Modern School. Those are the only ones which are hostels.
Understood.
And I think DPS RK Puram was, I think, just seen as more at scale, I guess. Mm. Whatever. Mm. My father felt that it was more at scale.
Got it. And then IIT Computer Science?
Yes, IIT Delhi Computer Science, I think. And then to US for a master's and working between US and India. And then IIM Ahmedabad.
Of course. I was curious. Many people come to IIMA right after IIT Delhi. I was curious about maybe the context behind the choices. How did you think about masters at that stage and then come back to IIMA? Walk us through those transitions.
So I was at heart, I mean, I think I always loved maths as a growing up kid. I think my father inculcated in this the love of maths. And I think I remember this growing up moment when there were these most scary 10 minutes of my day when he would be shaving and I would stand outside the bathroom.
Wow.
And he would ask me maths questions. Wow. You know, so that was my interrogation by fire. And the other thing was the Renan Martin. So there were only two things.
The English
Renan. So no past perfect continuous tense, you know, versus the, or whatever the case may be, or the, the active and the passive voice. So those were the two. He felt that if you knew maths and English, you'd be sorted for life. I think that were the two growing up skills. And I think, I don't know how much I learned on English, but I certainly learned maths. So in IIT, naturally, computer science was a close cousin of maths, and I fell in love with the subject. So I was a geek at heart. And I think naturally after IIT, while I got into IMA, my instinct was
that... Oh, you wrote the cat when you were...
Yeah, I did. And my instinct was that geeks are so much better off than all these MBA guys. And, you know,
fair hypothesis.
No, I don't know right or wrong. So I pursued my geekiness, you know, to study. And I was very excited about the prospect of computer graphics.
Right.
This is the era before animated movies started happening. Toy Story and all were after that. And somehow, you know, that caught my attention. And I pursued that. And the other topic was speech recognition. So I was kind of caught in that early years of that era. Technology was very different. This is a pre-HTML, that world. And that's where I did a master's. And naturally, after that, maybe you have a question. I don't want to kind of...
No. I think master's and then you joined Cadence Software, right? I was curious, IMA, one would have thought you might have considered a B school in the US for an MBA, given the choices you'd made. I was curious about you coming back to IMA after that experience. Especially given the default profile in IMA were people fresh out of engineering. So I was wondering if it would do justice to the experience you brought in.
So to be honest, a lot of my work at Cadence I did was in India. I was always very clear, even before I went to US for studying, that in the long term, I wanted to be in India. It wasn't because I felt India was a land of opportunity. It was just, I growing up, I was an Indophile. I just felt... Our nation deserved some of its people to stay and shape it. You know, I just somehow that was my growing up years. It was just one of those beliefs I had. So I had this deep desire that we should play a role in shaping our own nation. And I felt that my core decision tree was that if I go to US, it's not a 2-year decision. Then I will have to take a loan because I didn't have that much money to study abroad. It'll be at least a 4-year payback period. So I'm committing to a 6-year period. And then my network in India will be poor. Whereas if I went to an Indian business school, I would build local network.
Understood.
And hence, I would be here faster and that network whiz. So I did, in full transparency, I did try to go to an international school on a scholarship. So that would have changed the equation.
Within the constraints of your model.
Within the constraints of my model. And US school didn't offer. LBS had only one scholarship for an Indian school, the Chevening Scholarship.
Yes.
And I was in the last two for that scholarship. And I didn't get it. And I thank the guy who got it all the time. That guy is also at BCG, by the way. Guy who got it.
Wow.
He wasn't then, but came much later.
Understood.
So I thank him every day that, you know.
How small things. So just as a personal anecdote, after IIT Madras, I had a fellowship at UT Austin and IMA. And for some reason, I thought, the term that a lot of my seniors would use is X equals X plus one. You stay there and then you just keep moving the goalpost every year and you never come back. So somehow that stayed with me and I chose here. But
And I'll tell you one more thing. I joined IMA, then I went to Mr. Korwar, who was our... I asked him saying, I may have a shot at this LBS scholarship, but should I stay at IMA? He said, try LBS. So said, if he is saying it, then I should try.
Wow.
Right? So it was...
Achha, the decision was down the line.
Because I got in, but the scholarship decision happened. I remember I went for an interview somewhere in our first term.
Right.
Somewhere in the middle of the first term.
Got it. And it was good counsel, good objective counsel from him.
Yeah, I was impressed that he, being the head or, the dean or whatever his role was at that stage, he was still honest.
Lucky for us, you stayed. And it's wonderful. I mean, you spoke about nation building being at the corner of your mind. We'll talk about Plaksha and some of the other things you're doing. So you've sort of, in a way, what's inspiring is you've stayed true to that that desire over the years. And then BCG, post-IMA. It's 25 and a bit and counting.
And I think we were doing this informal survey among batchmates about people who started in this job and are still there. And I think out of three or four, two are BCG.
That's you
and Sharad Verma.
Absolutely.
Right? So I think a part of me, I mean, I used to be an Egon Zehnder recruiting for companies, right? So, and BCG is not for the faint-hearted, right? Or consulting in general is an intense profession with a certain demanding lifestyle. So what, if I may just flip it from Neeraj to BCG for a minute, what is it about the environment that sort of makes it possible for people to play the marathon in sprints?
It's a tough question. Look, I think, firstly, I went, before I went to IMA, just rolling the clock back, one of my dear friends at Cadence, a very close friend, Alok, had joined consulting.
And, is it Alok Goyal?
Alok Goyal, you know him, I think.
Stellaris.
And he joined McKinsey.
Yeah.
So it wasn't about one firm or the other. But he described his week, and he and I were together at Cadence, and he described how his average week felt like, how the average month felt like. So I felt what I was missing at Cadence a little bit was I was too much on, most of my time was spent on the screen and less with people. And I felt I was not getting the stimuli I used to get from a lot of people interaction. I think I was solving great, tough problems. Mm. I used to love solving that. But I was missing the people part of problem solving. So I got very energized by this profession which solves tough problems, but has a people lens to it.
It's a contact sport.
Yeah. So I went to IMA with a clear mindset that consulting is my top preferred profession. To the extent that my conviction to join business school, back to my point about I didn't want to go, came from that.
Interesting.
So, hence, once I left, you know, finding a consulting option was my natural progression. I don't think, I gave other, which are great professions, but that was never in my mind. Now, I think partly I will give credit to BCG, partly I will give credit to luck plays an important role in these things. I joined BCG at a very early stage. In India. We were a very small group of people. I felt it was a startup environment. I felt I owned a part of the firm always. So I played a role in shaping it. I wasn't a cog in the wheel. I was part of the wheel. Right? So that always is very endearing, right? So I felt we were a startup. Our back was against a much bigger incumbent at that time,
yes.
Which was, our competitor, where you worked in. So I think there was that. But equally, I think I made some of my best friends at BCG.
Got it.
Over the years. Friends who I've gone on vacations with, friends who I have shared my best moments or worst moments with, friends where we've grown up together. So it felt like an extension of college.
Right.
It didn't feel like corporate, right? And it felt like an extension of college where we worked hard, but we had a lot of fun together. And the years rolled by. And then, over a period of time, the firm evolved, I evolved, and my responsibilities changed. And it never felt like I was doing the same job over and over again.
Right.
Every 3 years or 2 years, the job felt different. And I think that just kept me going.
Got it. Let's double click on I evolved. I'm curious about many transitions in this process, but maybe a couple of transitions. One is maybe to the sort of the India leadership, managing partner of India, would that be the term? And then now subsequently Asia Pac. But I think particularly curious because two factors, right? One is, even if I go back to my executive search days, one of the things we would look for is how people lead vertically, which is sort of in their team, and how they lead horizontally, which is people like themselves who are as smart or even smarter than themselves. And at BCG, you're in a very sort of high caliber environment. And I think as I was preparing for this conversation, one of our friends, Venkatesh Srinivasan, I asked him, what are the couple of things that inspire you about Neeraj? And he said, one thing that he mentioned, and I also second that, is that stands out, Neeraj, is just the intensity of focus and attention and the ability to really go laser focused on a problem. But when you lead a group of people, you need to soften that intensity and you need to let others bring that intensity and sort of, in a way, create the climate for the problem solving. So talk to us a little bit about, maybe if I bring it back to the transition to heading India, What were some of the challenges? What were some of the adjustments you had to make in your ways of working, if you will, to be effective as a leader in India?
I think it is a shift from doing managing your own pyramid of people in your practice to leading the whole firm. Firstly, I mean, I think leading is a big word. I feel we deeply talk about servant leadership in BCG.
Mm.
And I feel that I embodied that. And I feel it serves well in any professional services environment.
Right.
Also in an academic environment.
Right.
So you're a bit about slightly a first among equals. Mm. You don't have to think like I'm the boss. You know, that of just course. Does not work. So if you think of an org chart, you put the partners on top and you put yourself below and not the other way around.
Mm.
And you live that every day. So you are... So what does that mean? I feel everybody is looking in the world from their own box. The job allows you to connect the dots in a more larger fashion.
Yeah.
And the job... So I think I took them on two attributes particularly. One was to connect the dots and see the larger role we are playing in India and shaping the India of tomorrow.
Hmm.
I also took over at a time when we were just reaching about 20 years in India. Hmm. So it was a nice moment for us as a firm to reflect back about our contributions to India. Hmm. And I'll talk about that later. And the second one was, while everybody is a superstar or star for sure to get to where they are getting, but everybody has some blind spots.
Hmm.
So my point was a bit of a human analysis, say, what is he or she good at? And what is here, where is their one blind spot? So I would focus only on the one or two blind spots to give them small nudges.
Interesting.
To get them to compensate and become... So if you take a... you know, here's how I would describe...
Give us an example, if you may. Yeah.
So, but before that, just to put in a concept, I think the role of a leader in general, I believe, and certainly in a professional services firm, is there is a normal distribution, right? Yep. But to make everybody a 10-20% better version of themselves. So move, if you see a distribution,
to
move
the
right
them up.
The role of a leader is shift everybody to the right, rather than say, this is correct or this is wrong. I think it's a fundamental flaw, certainly in my environment, which people make to say, this is acceptable, this is not acceptable.
Interesting.
I think, so I always embrace that it's not about right and wrong. It's about making everybody 20% better than themselves. That was my core job.
Very interesting.
I don't know if you hear that in other leadership discussions, but...
No, it's an interesting way of putting it to say, move them to the right of the bell curve. There are people, the people that talk about tolerance, to sort of talk about being non-judgmental, et cetera, but I like your framing of wherever you are. Of course, there's a minimum bar for performance and et cetera, but rather than being judgmental, being accepting and moving them to the right.
And so hence it was, that's why my whole point about, and you move it right by two things, I feel. One is by looking at what everybody has an example of. So somebody could be, there are a lot of people who have great IQ.
Yes.
But they are a little low on EQ.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that just, you know, and consulting profession particularly has exceptional IQ and often not, you know, you don't enjoy the time spent on the EQ. You consider this as a drag on your time, on your efficiency.
Yes.
So people are very measured. So I think often people find the EQ as a drag on their time. And hence, commonly my intervention used to be to make them feel like it is not a waste of time.
Mm.
All senior leaders have to spend time on that aspect as well.
Right.
You know, that's just an important part of being a leader.
Right.
And you do it, I feel, I used to tell them, you do it naturally with your clients.
Hmm.
You don't do it naturally inside.
Hmm.
So do be inside like you are outside is a very simple hack, but you know, people were not doing it enough. And the other thing was a magnet on the right to say, this is the larger purpose.
Hmm.
This is why we're doing this. So that also allows people to shift. So that's where my broader point about, so I had this simple framework linked to air, fire, water, earth.
Okay.
Air was about, you know, our position in the market, which was about, you know, we want to be market leaders. But fire was about innovation. Like we want to bring the best ideas to our clients. The latest idea, the next practices, not just the best practices. You know, like where do we push? So India should be a hub for innovation where the rest of BCG should say, we want to see how they do it and we want to get inspired, not bring the other way around. So how do we do that? Water was about, ultimately, this is the people business. So how do we, people will go through journeys, they will have moments of truth in their life. How do we adapt to their moments of truth and how do we flow with that? And earth was about giving back to Mother Earth. And in those days, it was about, can we impact 100 million lives in India? So the work we do with education, with health, with rural development, etc. How do we? So I think that was this, it was a simple construct: air, fire, water, earth. We used to start every meeting with that.
Wow!
And what are we doing to move the needle in that? At least all my leadership meetings. And it was a bit like a magnet.
Hmm.
It was a bit of a larger calling and a purpose.
Oh, beautiful! And this you came up with this sort of, you would say, was one of your.
So I mean, to be honest, it was me and a very young person. So she was a designer in our team. And I was doodling with this. And somewhere I wanted to embed it in the, you know, our basic elements and our version of the way the universe is. And she came up with this insight, Neeraj, what you're saying is sounding. So it was a bit of a jugalbandi.
Beautiful.
Of what she had and I had, and we kind of built on each other. So it was inspired thing. And that's the beauty of the job. You know, one of the things I've learned is all the wisdom resides in the firm.
True.
It's only about unearthing it, right?
I mean, and that's listening, just, and listening with an open mind.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Without hierarchy and tenure. So wonderful. And talk to us about the journey from, let's say, heading India to leading Asia Pacific. Again, if you were to talk about that transition, what were the, if I may say, the big adjustments you had to make to be effective? It's been, what, 2-3 years in this role? How long?
No. It's been 7 years almost in the role.
In the APAC role?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's
time complete.
Yeah, 2018 is when I took it. It's been a long time.
Correct.
I think the India role, I was in the details. Right, because when I took over the India role, we were about, I think, I forget, but roughly around 30 partners or thereabouts. So I roughly knew what was going on in everybody's life. I knew the details to the extent I could. I knew what was going on in every client.
You also had the relationships.
Trust. Absolutely. Yeah. I think you are 1 degree removed when you take on the Asia role. Firstly, geographically, it's a very widespread. B, you are not native to everybody's context. So I think what it meant was, I changed my approach to how do you inspire people to find their best, as opposed to tell them what I couldn't, you know, it was about inspiring them by role modeling, as opposed to always telling, you know, you couldn't tell. You were not in the details, close enough of the details by telling. So I think, the tools were different. But every starting geography, our context was different. One firm across Asia, but our starting point in China was different from Japan, was different from Australia, was different from Indonesia. So you also then had to adapt it to our startup. Some places our brand was very strong, our market position was very strong. Some places it had room for improvement. So you also had to adapt it to the context. It was not one playbook.
Got it.
You had to have multiple playbooks playing all the time. So, you know, so it was that. So, yeah.
And while you spoke about servant leadership, was there any tweaks to the leadership style based on the culture? Let's say, is there a certain kind of leadership which is a little more effective in a China versus a Japan versus India? Any nuance that...
Huge nuances. Asia is loaded with culture.
Exactly.
Right. Loaded with
culture. It's like seven continents within the continent.
Right. You know,
right?
Exactly. In Japan, you know, so once you make a decision, everybody listens, everybody follows, and it happens, right? I mean, like it's just once aligned, it happens. In Korea, also, you know, very classically hierarchical society. So there is a bit different from, certainly very different from Japan, but has elements which are, you know, like the boss is saying it kind of stuff, right? I mean, has elements about that. And, but there were multiple, in our business, there were, you know, multiple iconic leaders and they didn't see eye to eye at some stage. So it also had its second layer complications of, you know, they were to aligning
across,
their...
Across markets or...
No, even in one market itself, right? Okay. So aligning that itself was a different challenge.
Right.
So like... think of it as, I don't know if that's a word, but it could almost be seem like, are you in this camp or that camp kind of
right.
a problem.
Right.
I think China, while my, at the end, learning was their DNA is very similar to ours.
Is it? Wow.
You know, they are very driven, very hungry on some aspects, not on every aspect. On some aspects, very similar. The family matters. Every mother and father has spent time to make their kids,
right.
You know, they're extraordinarily invested in the family and their
Everyone's
success.
Had their version of the shaving test.
Yeah, I'm sure. Or the piano test or whatever. You know, everybody has worked their, you know, whatever, which body part you would imagine off. They worked really, really hard to get to where they are. Hugely driven. But I think... they were in a more homogeneous environment than India has a heterogeneity of environment. So heterogeneity gives us a certain calmness which comes. The homogeneity sometimes can rattle them when the environment gets a bit, you know, I think that's because it's a much more culturally, language-wise, a much more homogeneous kind of environment, right? So there is some differences.
Got it.
And Southeast Asia is multiple cultures, right? I mean, you can't paint it with one brush. So Indonesia or Vietnam will be very different, or Singapore will be very different. But I think the gift, I would say, which the Indians have, which I think certainly is our ability to deal with ambiguity. I think you find a lot of Indians in leadership positions across the world.
Yes.
It's not because, I think certainly Indians are smart, but there are many other people who are smart. I think our ability to, we live in a world which is hugely ambiguous. So ambiguity is a part of our DNA. Ambiguity does not rattle us. In many Asian cultures, ambiguity creates problems. People like, so one of the things I was difficult as a leader to deal with is, I could keep things ambiguous till the last moment.
I understand.
I never, but people like 2 weeks before we commit and then we deliver on the commitment. You know, last minute disruptions are very hard for the Asian cultures. So I was that part of my leadership style was hard for people to deal
with. And what is it about Indian, let's say growing up in India, that sort of, I mean, different people have different takes, but what's your instinct on the reasons why a lot of people grow up with comfort with ambiguity? What is it about the Indian system?
I think partly, given our state of infrastructure, given our state of anything, you always have to have a plan A, plan B, plan C.
You just need to look at the roads and the traffic.
Exactly. You know, so you're naturally wired to, you know, in the moment, just drop a plan and pick up a new plan. I think there's also, we underestimate how much diversity we have and how, and people look at the same problem differently. I mean, we are a Europe state, kind of, we are a continent-sized country, right? In some sense of, certainly in terms of diversity.
Yes.
So that naturally makes us ready for not one point of view and a multitude of point of view. So I think these two things, certainly.
Got it. Neeraj, I wanted to move to a different theme from, let's say, just the work thing to the, if I may zoom out a little bit. One of the things that strikes me about you is how you manage your energy, right? I think one of the things that comes up in my coaching with leaders is often just energy management, right? How do you do things in a way that conserves your energy so that you take care of not just the P&L, but also your balance sheet so that you can play the long game? Given your remit, Neeraj, and I go back even 25 years, 27 years, back in campus, we would have a demanding schedule in IMA, but I would see you play frisbee every evening and sort of be, you know, you were always, there was a certain, if I may say, disciplined balance. And again, Venkatesh used the same term. So talk to us a little bit about just your, how you, what your typical day looks like, specifically given you travel quite a bit. You also run half marathons, there's a certain fitness you keep. Talk to us about how you manage your energy.
So I have no typical day. I probably have a typical month at best, because my job needs, one of the joys of the job is there's so much variety and every week feels a bit different, but in a month or a quarter may have a rhythm to it.
Okay.
You know, so sorry for not a day answer.
That's fine.
But I think I've over the period found out things which give me energy. So I think great interactions firstly give me energy. So I think that's, I'm in a right profession in that sense because I tend to have very often great. So learning from people who have, I get to meet people across a wide band of search, both within BCG, but also beyond BCG.
Yes.
And I always feel that's one of the most joyful parts of my job. So that itself gives me energy, right? So finding a job which gives you energy is helpful and my job does not drain energy.
Lovely.
It gives me energy. I think my kids give me energy because when they're small to, they are so challenging. They make you humble. They make you grounded. And they, I think Khalil Gibran's poem that your children are not your children. Their life's longing for itself. They come from you. They don't belong to you. I deeply believe in that. And I think they'll let you appreciate how unique they are and how different they are and how little you know about. So I think as well. And I think sports has always given me energy. So I've always tried to play or embrace some kind of physical activity. And it has moved on from half marathon. Now my recent passion is to get good at badminton.
What was it?
I play a lot with my son. He's much better at me than I am on sport now. He's 15. But, or gym. Gym has been an active part of my life. So things I can do in like contained, I, uh, think so. And I think having purpose. So Plaksha, which has also been something, it means more time, but it has been very rewarding. So I think doing more things, but enjoying being in the moment and enjoying them in the moment has given me energy.
You make it look very simple, Neeraj. But back to one of the things you said BCG gives me energy, but I'm sure you've sort of made, even within BCG, you've probably made a set of micro choices to align the kinds of things you do towards what gives you energy. So can you talk a little bit about some of the choices you might have made to sort of ensure that you're in the zone of, you know, energy generation rather than depletion?
So I think I've always felt life is too short to work with clients you don't like. So I work with clients I like as opposed to I don't like, right? I mean, you know, so I think, and there are many I like, but there are some I didn't and I would then not, you know. So I think, you know, so that is, you can make that choice.
Understood.
Equally, people you choose, when you're choosing to work with. Actually, but as I've matured, I've actually appreciated to work with people who are very dissimilar to me also. Because they let you see your own blind spots. So actually, you know, in the past, I needed to be right more often. But I've learned to, I don't know if I've learned to say less. I try to say less. But I've certainly learned to observe more and appreciate duality, you know, whatever you want to call it, of perspectives.
Right.
And I think being in more recently in our exec committee, which is 11 different nationalities of 14 people, has allowed me to see how the same problem can be examined by so many different lenses. And it's been genuinely a joy. You know, how a Scandinavian will look very differently to an American, to an Italian, to an Australian, to a Korean. You know, just that has been an exercise of great learning.
What's inspiring about Neeraj is that the way he manages his energy, there's a certain intentionality about making it holistic. You know, there's health, there's purpose, there's relationships. Even with the clients, he talks about how he's intentional about the kinds of people that give him positive energy. What I've noticed is if you really want to play the long game, unless you're really intentional about being holistic, there's a risk of burnout or a fade out. I published a book, Play to Potential, Lead a Full Life, Become the Best You, which was published by Penguin around November 2024. Happy to say that it's gone on to become a national bestseller. But on the sidelines of this podcast conversation, I also got an opportunity to sit with Neeraj and get his reflections on the book and what he took away from it. Neeraj, you were kind enough to share a few words of advanced praise on the book Play to Potential. I'm curious to understand what stayed with you, you know, when you read the book, if you want to share a sort of maybe share a couple of things that stayed with you when you read the book.
So I think, firstly, the framework flavor connected with me. I told you this the very first time you told me.
Thank you.
And particularly, I think the VO part of it, to me, had a, you know, every framework had something which instinctively appeals to you. You know, I, for example, in BCG values, there's this one value we have, expand the art of the possible, that deeply connects with me as a person. So this VO had this magic about it, which I think just deeply, deeply connected with me. Of course, I, you know, don't get me wrong, I love every aspect of you know, the F and the R, the family, the relationship, everything. So I think there was something there you unearthed, which was magical. And I think how you also did not try to, I think you brought it to brass tacks on by taking people from various facets of life. There's a certain playbook of leadership. You kind of brought it to the examples you took of whether Sumit or Soma or other people who I know very well.
Yes.
And I deeply admire and respect. And I think connecting it to that made the framework more both endearing and something to aspire to. So it connected in a very deep fashion. Otherwise, many of the books, they have such untouchable people as examples. I think not that these are not untouchable. They are also. But I think they just feel like they live in a different world and they don't connect with my world kind of stories.
And one of the things I should mention is when we had dinner, you, Priyanka and you and me, one of the metaphors you used was metaphor of a lotus.
Yes.
As an Asian way of looking at leadership. And interestingly enough, when I spoke to Shoma, about when I asked her the question about what do you think play to potential means, she said life should be like a lotus. You should unfurl like a lotus because just three things come out and the other petals don't. It's not a good sight.
So since you raised a lotus point, I think a lotus is rooted. It is, but at the same time, it is reaching for light. So back to my point about, and it has an interconnectedness below the water. So that is so wonderful about Lotus. And I think that is what is needed in everybody's life also.
Lovely, Neeraj. Thanks for your time on the podcast and for your kind words about the book.
No, absolutely. I would absolutely recommend everybody to make time to read it, or at least go through some parts of it. And it's something you go to over and over again. It's not a one-time read.
Got it. Thank you. If this piques your curiosity, do look up the book at Amazon, and you can find the print, Kindle, or Audible versions, whatever works for you. Let's now get back to the conversation with Neeraj Agarwal. That's a great point you make. And just to sort of even observe and sort of hold these multiple perspectives concurrently without saying this is right, that is wrong, or, you know, without judging. Powerful. And maybe just being very tactful.
And maybe I'll add one more thing. I think I've learned earlier, I used to be too in the moment. So I would have an emotion and I would express it. I've learned to add maybe a 15-second or a 1-minute time lag to my emotion. I think it's a acquired skill, but that allows me not to not hit the highs and the lows that much. I feel nothing is reason to feel that good, or nothing is reason to feel that bad. If you just add a little bit of time lag to my emotion.
And can you talk about the how, if I may stay with that?
It's just training of your mind to say, like, whatever emotion is, just add a delay function to it. You know, it's just I don't have more to it, but it's a mental training to say, like, early on, okay, here's how I trained my mind, actually, now that I remember it. Early on, if there was an emotion, I would do a tally mark at the back of my notebook.
Wow.
So in a meeting, I would have 20 tally marks. So I got it down to 10, to 5, and then I got it down to 0. I just trained my mind to... So every time I had an emotion, particularly negative emotion, I would add a tally mark. I would add a tally mark. And
is there any particular emotion, or in general when you have a volatility or a surge?
Yeah, a surge of emotion. Particularly when I disagreed strongly, I would add a tally mark. So, like, you know, sometimes, you know, the best way to, and I would, in the past when I had a disagreement, sometimes I would be sharp in my rebuttal. But now I sometimes feel just making a joke out of it. Sometimes just having a smile and, you know, making the person realize the idiosyncrasy of what they are saying, you know, is just sometimes better, right?
Land the message in a softer
way. Exactly. So I think that's been I wish I had the skill earlier in life, but I've really enjoyed acquiring that skill.
Fascinating. Now, one of my earlier guests was a gentleman called Rich Fernandez. He was running Search Inside Yourself, which is a company incubated in Google, which they spun it out separately. And he spoke about the distinction between responding and reacting. And responding is basically the delay function that you speak about, which is really how do you... And he talks about mindfulness and some of the other methods. So I was curious if there was... But tally marks, I think it's fascinating. I think there's also, if I may come in, there's enough research to say journaling or sort of some element of putting pen to paper, which apparently is like running a version update on yourself. So in a way, this to me also feels like one of those things where there's a certain... You're going through, you're observing, there's a pen to paper, there's a reflection, there's feedback, there's correction. Rich Fernandez, the person I refer to in my conversation with Neeraj, uses the term response flexibility versus reaction. He goes on to talk about how we all can find simple strategies in the rhythm of our day to move from reacting to responding.
When people think about meditation, they think about having to do exactly what I just said, which is set aside, you know, X block of time and, you know, sit in a certain way and close your eyes and protect this space for formal practice. But there's also a way to practice mindfulness and meditation in an integrated way. So for example, as you move through the course of your day, integrate it into your day. Between meetings, you know, if you need to walk to the restroom, make that a walking meditation. I'm actually serious about that, right? Become aware of your body as it moves through space between your office and the restroom. Become aware of your footfall. Become aware of, you know, the felt sense of your body. How are you feeling actually in that moment? Or take the opportunity to focus on breath, or this being in India, this podcast, you know, if you have a mantra that you're, you know, that you're familiar with or particularly like, use that. And I say mantra, and there's often a religious component to that, but here, what I'm referring to is really finding an object of your attention to train your attention upon it, whether it be mantra or breath or walking or sensation. You can really do this throughout the course of your day. I was driving to work today and I was focusing on my breath, not so much so that I wasn't able to drive, But when there was a red light, when I was stopped in traffic, in and out for three breaths, I noticed my breath. Next stoplight, same thing. Integrated practice is also a helpful one. One thing we know also, another bit of neuroscience, is that what they found is that people have a better memory for things they've written down than that which they've typed in a classroom setting. That's been a finding in neuroscience. And what neuroscientists have found is the reason for that is that because we can type faster than we can write longhand. And we could type almost at the speed of what's being spoken. And so basically what we're doing is we're just essentially quickly processing but not encoding what's being said, okay? And when you write something longhand, like when you journal, you actually have to articulate entire thoughts in your head and they become encoded in your memory in a much stronger fashion. And so basically you're programming yourself in another sense of the word when you journal. You're programming your brain to perceive a situation, you know, through a certain lens or perspective, and it becomes much more real and concrete. And in some ways you start to live your way into that, if that makes any sense. So the what I would say for journaling to get started or to habituate it, make it more of a habit, think about a prompt. Today I feel dot, 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 and then just write for 2 minutes without stopping, stream of consciousness.
While there is no one approach, I love what Neeraj says about using tally marks to work on his delay function. All it takes is a little bit of attention and intentionality. If this is of interest, you might like the membership section at playtopotential.com. We have curated specific insights by theme, including mindfulness, where there are many perspectives from multiple speakers across disciplines on the one topic you care about. You'll find this at playtopotential.com. That's PlayToPotential.com in the curated playlist section. Let's get back to the podcast now.
Yeah, and I take a lot of flights, and I enjoy just the silence of you're sitting on your seat. There's nobody to talk to. I normally am very incommunicative on the flight, and I just take a blank piece of paper. And I'm lost in my own thoughts. And that's my best time to, I don't know if that's system two or, processing what all, because you're normally on the treadmill all the time.
Yes, yes.
And that's my reflection function. And some of my best reflections happen in those moments.
And is there a structure to it, or just be with yourself?
Be with yourself, like no other stimuli I want. I never watch TV. I normally don't eat in the flight. And I just be quietly just a piece of paper and a pen.
And just maybe staying with flights, I was going to come to it. Fitness, right? You spoke about gym and badminton and other stuff. Very tactically, especially, I'm sure you do your share of straddling multiple time zones, India to Singapore, Singapore to Japan, etc. So what's your, for people that are sort of moving across time zones, are there one or two maybe... Hacks is too simple a word, but are there a couple of rituals that you've developed over time that have served you well to manage your energy?
It's a tough thing, firstly. And it's got tougher, a little tougher with age. Till about a couple of years ago, I never had a problem. But my simple rule is I sleep. So if it's a long flight, I only do two things. I never drink alcohol. I almost don't eat. And I only reflect and I only sleep. So if it's a 12-hour flight, I will have 2-3 hours of reflection and 9 hours of sleep. So when I land having slept enough.
Fully rested.
Yeah. And I would have a good eye mask, which like literally blocks out any kind of light. And sound doesn't bother me. Light is the only thing which bothers me. So I always invest in good eye masks. And I never try not use the airline one. I have carry my own. So that's a simple hack.
Okay.
And then I always feel the other simple hack is I will try to adapt immediately to the clock of the new time zone, right? Because I've normally slept enough and I would adapt, having light dinners so that you can sleep is super helpful. What else? At times you have to have a lot of coffee. I have never, ever had melatonin. in my life.
Understood.
You know, so.
Understood. Changing tracks, Neeraj. Priyanka Agarwal is a senior leader at BCG as well. What have you and Priyanka learned about managing two intense careers and raising two kids, right? Not easy. So what, talk to us about sort of, if I may, your reflections of, you know, having pursued two intense careers. What does it take to make it work?
So firstly, I'm genuinely, eternally grateful to her for doing more than fair share. And also for dealing with my idiosyncrasies, you know. So I think I don't say that often enough. But equally, it has also been knowing when each other needs, are going through those highs and lows.
Mm.
And giving each other the that extra space or that, you know, to talk it out, to reflect. So being a bit of a sounding board for each other. Covering up for travel, you know, although I think in the early days, till our kids were about 6 and 9, I think we tried to manage travel so that one of us was always at home. And there she certainly did far more, but I also tried to find a lot of local clients. I think that helped. I think the one thing we are proud of is if they were, like every kid had the moment of truth beyond the birthday, the school functions and others. I think in the last, in our their growing up years, we probably missed less than 1% of the moments of truth.
So just give us an example. What do you mean by moments of truth?
So the big play in the school, the big sports day, the big birthday party, the whatever. I mean, like, you know, I think...
A milestone event.
A milestone event, right? Yeah, maybe that's the moment. Or a doctor's appointment or whatever the case may be. So I think we've always made... And I think that has been the inviolable block on the calendar. And both have been there. It's not like one has been there. So the general rule is that, you know, both will always be there. I think that has, I think, been a general rule. And I've, as I said, we've always had some rituals of, like, as the kids in the early days, we would play with them. But as they gotten older, there's a certain board games we played. And the skill level of the board games kept improving as they got from, you know, early days of Monopoly and Ludo to Catan and Ticket to Ride and whatever else they have been. And I think so those rituals have made us kind of connected as well.
Got it. Actually, as I was preparing for this conversation, I did ask her about a couple of questions that, you know, given she knows the Neeraj behind the curtains, what are the
couple
what are the couple of things about Neeraj that we could learn from? I think she mentioned a couple of things which struck me, Neeraj. One is sort of, I'm quoting her here, optimism to the point of being delusional. And the other thing was just sort of trust as default, you know, as a default setting, unless proven otherwise. Talk to us about, you know, just where these come from, how they've helped you, and just, you know, how you've worked with these two as you've gone about your life and the choices you've made.
I think both of them, she's nailed it. I'm always a glass half full rather than the glass half empty. I've always felt that, you know, if enough smart people put their mind to it, they can solve any problem or most problems. I shouldn't say any problems. And I've believed in the collective power of humans to solve toughest issues. And I think that generally gives me the reason for being optimistic in most places.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually feel if we had a choice to make, I'd rather feel good about that, you know, rather than bad. You know, that's just some of it. I don't know where it comes from, but that's just been my being.
And is that a training, like you spoke about reacting versus responding? Would you say that's a cultivated skill?
I think some of it was just wired in me from the very early years. Maybe I in my growing years, I saw people who were either kind and I connected more with people. There are choices you make as a kid. I don't want to be like that. I want to be like this. I think people who were glass half empty, I made early choices of, I don't want to be like that. That's not what I enjoy. And I think, you know, it was a subconscious process. I don't think it was a conscious process. On the other one, yes, on the trust. I feel, you know, there's a simple theory I have. Nobody wakes up to be a bad person. Everybody is very, in their mind, does the right things, right? And I also believe every saint had a past and every... you know, whatever, criminal has a future.
It's like the sine curve or the cost curve.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I believe that people repay trust with trust. And that has been a good mantra. I've been very rarely disappointed. If you, you know, if you genuinely say to a person, look, I trust you and I'll back you. So my rule has always been, I'll back you the first time, I'll back you the second time. But if the third time you don't repose the trust, then I will not back you.
Understand.
I have rarely had to use the third time.
I go back to one of my professors in LBS, economics professors. And this was a conversation about game theory. And one of the things he said was when they ran simulations, the strategy that worked was what they called generous tit for tat.
Generous tit for tat. Okay. So you have a framework for that, which
I'm just sort of trying to relate it to. So he said, first time, you always have a choice of cooperate versus be selfish, right? So first time the opponent is selfish, you still cooperate. One more time you cooperate, then you sort of go for the tit for tat. I mean, not the same situation.
Yeah, but it's an elegant framework. I had not thought of it like this. I think it captures...
You're not taken for granted, but at the same time, benefit of doubt.
Correct, right? Exactly.
That's sort of the...
And I'll tell them that you didn't deliver on this, but I believe in you and I'll back you one more time, but don't try it the third time.
It actually worked as a student back to IMA. I remember one of our profs, Kannan Sethuraman, he used to teach ops. And one of the courses, I remember, I was a reasonably good student in ops, but in that exam, I took a shortcut or copied or whatever. And he called me to, I did some shortcut or did something silly because there were multiple deadlines and, you know, just something out of desperation. And he called me to his room and said, I know you're capable of better
Far
things.
Far better than that, yeah.
So I can give you a D here. But I'm going to give you whatever, one more day. And can you show me what you can do?
And I have many stories.
And sort of that stayed with me, right? I think.
Exactly. I think I was a very optimized student at IIT Delhi. Like I used to believe output over input ratio has to be maximized. And one day, the head of our department in computer science, who I never used to get along with, called me and said, Neeraj, I don't care what you do in life, but whatever you do, excel at that. So I think it stayed with me that excellence is a very important part of our life, just not optimizing. So I think I moved that day from an output to input maximizer to an excellence seeker. It was a profound shift from a person who I never really got along with.
That brings me to the other point Priyanka made, caring about the last 1% excellence. Talk to us about the sort of situations where that shows up, or where you sort of push for that 1%.
I always say there's a very fine line between very good and excellent. And let's try to be on the right-hand side of the line. I feel clients can tell when you're excellent versus very good. I feel other person can tell when you're genuinely, you know, that. I think the market can tell. So, and but the pursuit from very good to excellent is not a 1% extra effort. It's about 50% extra effort. But it is that close. And I feel in the longest time in every profession, the seeking excellence, whatever level you may be at, it really should be a calling card. So I tell this to all my clients, right? Or all the people I touch, right? I mean, it could be a youngster. It really goes back to my head of my department in computer science. I say, I don't care what you do, genuinely, right? You could be in the music industry, you could be a consultant, you could be in the corporate world, you could be a teacher, whatever. But, you know, what do you stand for? You have to stand for being excellent in something. Right. And I think that, as human beings, I think that's what we should all aspire for. Yeah.
That's a beautiful point, actually. If I may come in, one of the people I spoke to was a gentleman called Atul Kasbekar. He's a reputed photographer. He used to be a chemical engineer in UDCT. And one of the things he said was, in any industry, as we move forward, there'll be that 1% that will be in demand because they are the artists of that profession. And one level below will be a sort of crapshoot because it's commoditized. And if you play there, then you'll be commoditized away. So the only, actually, in a way, almost it's an existential need wherever you are.
Correct.
To sort of really be that artist or be that sort of beacon of excellence.
With AI coming in, I feel the bar on being relevant is just going higher and higher. Atul Kasbekar, a celebrated photographer, speaks about the importance of being at the top of a profession and the middleman being wiped out.
And the other thing is, there are just far too many human beings out there. You know, there's just whatever it is you're looking to do, there is someone who's willing to do it cheaper.
Yep.
Okay. I don't know about better, but certainly cheaper. Now, and there are not that many clients out there who want to pay for Louis Vuitton. You know, so either you have to be so good, okay, that, yaar, wo chahiye to uske baad jana hi padega. Then whether you're a kadiya placing marble, but what you do, you're a freaking artist. You know, great. you'll get the money and you'll get paid your due. If not, you better be the guy who's literally everywhere and you're the Coke can. You know, you're 30 feet away from whoever and then you whatever. So I think that in-between guy is going to get wiped out if you're not careful. So you just need to sort of be everywhere. That's at a very simplistic level. I'm no economist, but it seems like that's the way.
Back to what Neeraj says, striving for excellence, I'm not sure, is a differentiator anymore. You could say it's almost essential for survival these days. I want to move to a slightly different theme, Neeraj. AI.
I've
listened to some of your talks after Davos, and clearly, even otherwise, I'm sure you're in many of your conversations with leaders around the world, and this comes up. How do you see AI impacting leadership? You know, if I were to ask you, the leader of today compared to, let's say, a leader of 20 years back, what has changed? What does it mean to be a more effective leader in the world of AI?
So I think firstly, even before AI, two things. AI, I think, is a profound shift in the world. I genuinely believe it is not blockchain. It is not quantum. It's a profound shift. And second, the leaders of the 20th century leadership and the 21st century leadership has changed in many ways. I think the command and control hierarchical leadership to a place where you are an ecosystem orchestrator has become, you know, so I think Satya says it well, you know, from a know-it-all to a learn-it-all. I think, I don't know if he came up with it or whatever, I heard it from him. And I genuinely think a know-it-all to a learn-it-all, the Jack Welch era of a leadership was a know-it-all kind of stuff, is a very profound shift. And I think that gets accentuated in the world of AI. Because you will, firstly, anyway, the youngsters in your organization knew more than you. The ecosystem partners knew more than you. But now the technology may know more than you, right? So you have to firstly get comfortable with that, right? That's a very important attribute. But equally, the integrative skill is a very hard skill. Very few people have it. You know, I think knowledge at some stage maybe may become a commodity. But the integration of knowledge, I mean, there are people who, I mean, Vinod Khosla recently said in the TED Talk, labor will be free, knowledge will be free, kind of stuff. I mean, maybe, but I think the integration of different sources of knowledge, because knowledge is not one, I mean, there's so many, I think that to me is a hard skill still. And to be able to know what does integration mean? One is different opinions. Sometimes, you know, is there a middle path or is there, where do you lean in? One could be play the axis of time. One could be a here and now decision. One could be a time series decision. One could be, look, both could be realities. I have to take a call. You know, I am just going to. Or sometimes finding 1 + 1 = 2 is a very important skill. So I feel that part of leadership is going to be very critical. So the leaders of tomorrow will be more learn-it-all, will be more integrative. And I feel that's why I think women are naturally a lot better at that than men. So I have a positive view that there will be more women leaders in the world of tomorrow.
Interesting.
Because it comes naturally that comes to them more by default. They're better at this, I think. I don't know, but this is just my personal instinct. This is just, this is not a BCG formula. This is just my view.
Of course, of course.
This is Deepak here. I'm reminded of my conversation with Vinay Sitapati, the author of Half Lion, the biography of a former Prime Minister Narasimha Rao. He spoke about how Narasimha Rao assembled a team of highly qualified people around him. When I further asked Vinay about how Narasimha Rao was able to add value on top, he spoke about the same integrative capability that Neeraj alluded to a minute back.
Well, I'll give you Narasimha Rao's view, which is that he trusted people around him, right? But he also realized that the expert knows only one thing. But a problem may have multiple components. You know, Manmohan Singh understands, you know, tariff reductions very well. Manmohan Singh doesn't know how to get it through the Lok Sabha. Manmohan Singh doesn't know how to get it through the Rajya Sabha, right? The you know, an IFS officer, diplomat will tell you that, look, we need to make overtures to Israel, right? The diplomat doesn't know that you need the political signaling of hugging Yasser Arafat, right? So I think Narasimha's remarkable ability was that he relied on experts, right? But he knew that he alone had the 360 degree view.
And the how part, as you said.
And the how part, right? And the how part requires a 360 degree view, you know? In fact, I don't know whether this is relevant to this conversation, but, you know, my former boss, Shekhar Gupta, would always tell me that, you know, the difference between Indian leadership and Pakistani leadership is that democratic politicians are forced to take the 360-degree view. Whereas Pakistani, you know, leaders, typically dictators, military dictators, are all looking at the army view, army view, army view. And the army view is just one view, right? Musharraf knows how to attack Kargil. He doesn't know how to be a diplomat, right? He doesn't know how the economy works. So, you know, we are in, you know, the, in any organization, right? We are going for specialist, 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 right? But the ultimate decision maker has to realize what is good for the entire organization. And that was Narasimha Rao, right? And that's another reason why he felt that even though Manmohan Singh knew more about him than in finance, A.N. Verma, who was a former industry secretary, understood industries very well. K.N. Venugopal, Yugandhar, understood welfare scheme. He was the only person who had the keys to all kingdoms. And decisions required that.
Let's get back to the conversation with Neeraj now. And I think maybe switching gears, we'll talk about Plaksha in a minute, but just maybe given you have access to youngsters, of course you have two kids, young kids, but also I'm sure you're seeing hundreds of them through Plaksha. What does AI mean in terms of how people who are sort of entering the world of universities, the world of careers, what has shifted?
Yeah.
You know, what's your advice to sort of this generation of people?
So I think it is like everybody has a superhuman suit or a Marvel suit, if you watch the Marvel movies kind of stuff that they can wear. So I think, and the benefit is I can make my hour seem like five, right? Because there's so many places where I can outsource the work to the AI engine, whatever your favorite engine is. That being said, so we did an interesting study in BCG where we said the gap between an average consultant and a good consultant reduced with the power of AI on some tasks. But some of the most creative tasks, AI can actually sometimes create so many options that navigating in them. So on the more, you know, the less creative tasks, but where you needed hard work, the gap reduces. But on the more creative tasks, you can actually also get, at least the current version of AI, you can get overwhelmed.
Interesting.
And there, it can create negative entropy rather than positive energy.
Because of decision-making becomes
complex. Because if you're doing marketing, and yes, it can generate 20 different options.
It's a paradox of choice.
Yeah. It's a paradox of choice, exactly.
Yeah. Fascinating. So bringing it to the youngsters of today, so the advice is tune into your strengths. I'm just curious about...
So I would have a couple of advice.
In terms of being relevant.
Because partly the technology hallucinates. So, you know, A, do not abdicate completely to technology.
Yeah.
I still feel learning maths is important. Learning some of the basic skills, the learning language is important. I think what my dad taught me is still important. I don't think you should abdicate to technology.
Yeah.
I remember when one Google Maps got me in a 80-mile loop in Germany, which was a circular loop. After doing it twice, I realized that I was in a circular loop. I was not making progress. And I had to use my human instinct.
Happened once,
you know.
Wow.
And my daughter is learning driving, and I told her, learn the manual car. Because she said, Dad, who drives a manual? I want to learn automatic. I said, there is maybe that one time that you need. So I do not feel we should abdicate completely.
Understood.
I think having that ability to, yes, you should use it for convenience, but you should practice that's one thing. Second, particularly on the creative aspects, you know, so there are some skills, the technology is not good at all skills.
Yes.
So knowing where it is good at, use it, but knowing where it is not the best, you know, so knowing where to pull in and where to let go is also important.
And even that's a human element, right?
Yeah.
The judgment of when to use the machine. I remember when I spoke to Vishy Anand in the context of the podcast, I remember asking him about Deep Blue and the fact that machines are getting smarter than men or women. And I remember him saying, you know, what's man versus machine is not the conversation. Man plus machine versus man plus machine is a real conversation. And where's that going and what can you do with it?
Chess is a very interesting example, because while Deep Blue became better than Kasparov in the second round and has the ELO rating of a machine is much higher than a human. But I think since technology has come, more humans play chess than before. Chess.com is one of the most endearing sites in the world. I'm sure Vishy must have talked about it.
And he also said machines often bring out edge cases that humans overlook, and has actually made the game richer.
Yeah.
Because humans would have had a certain linear, whatever, a certain set of pathways, but machines often come up with other pathways that we've not seen.
And actually, players have gotten much better.
That, and also, I'm sitting alone by myself. It can create a competitor for me who's at my level and I can play
spar.
So it's created spar, you know, an ability for... So I'm quite excited by possibilities also, which we may not have imagined originally.
True. And one of the things people talk about in the context of AI, Neeraj, is just what does being human mean in the context of machines? Do you have a take on that? You know, therefore, if we really extrapolate where it's going.
So firstly, two things I would say. In our clients, we, as BCG, I'll use one phrase. We use this 10, 20, 70. We say 10 is the algorithm, 20 is the data or the tech, but 70 is the people element of any change. So there are lots of enterprises where the 10 and the 20 happen, but the 70 of taking people along in the journey, where people have to unlearn and learn, where people have to be made, where, you know, you have to make, rather than tell and push, you have to create pull, is a very important part. And we don't do that side of the change. I think the other side of the change is the technology is still too clinical, right? Everything in the world is not about just, the parallel is the IQ and the EQ still. I think it's you create a great IQ tool, but the best magic happens when you combine IQ with EQ. So the human side, maybe one day the technology will get very good at that as well. But till such time, and that is a scary time if it becomes very good at that. But till such time, I think the EQ is knowing what to use. Because IQ is like a hammer. But knowing when to use a soft hammer or the hard hammer is a gift you need to have.
Yeah. Got it. Neeraj, I wanted to change topics.
Okay.
Plaksha.
Sure.
Again, I've had the opportunity to attend some of the sessions. I would love to visit the campus. I spoke to Arvind Agarwal.
Right? Yeah.
A few times, so would love to visit. It's been on my list. But curious about where the seeds were sown, your vision for it, you know, and maybe subsequently, you know, what have you learned about leadership in this context as compared to, let's say, leadership in the context of BCG? I'd love for your reflections on that as well.
Got it. So I think it's been a decade since I got involved in this journey. So it started in a very modest way in 2015 when 3-4 of us, who all went to IIT Delhi, were one or two batches apart, got together. But I think the core driving factor was a belief that, a couple of beliefs. One is that technology will shape the future of the world. And hence we need, but our current leading institutes were not evolving enough to keep pace with the changing times. And hence we needed to create a new playbook. And the theory of change there was, if we create something which is an iconic playbook, it will lift the water level of everything, right? And I think the inspiration on ISB changing, pushing the IIMs to a different level was certainly there behind our minds. And maybe perhaps to a certain extent, even Ashoka doing that on the liberal arts side was behind our mind. That was one. The second thing was, you know, we all talk and, I mean, I've told you about, I'm very passionate about playing a role in shaping India in whatever form or shape I can, was we should use our best years to not just to give time to shaping that. Not in a day job, but beyond a day job. So the hardest part and the biggest commitment was to say, you know, when I started thinking about Plaksha, I was in the early 40s, that, you know, and it wasn't a lightweight commitment to say it will get done in a year or two. To over the next multi-decades, we will invest some quality time.
True.
And it's been a decade and at least, I feel I've at least given 20% time to that. Magic time particularly, often a lot on the weekends, which is taken away from other things. But that was a commitment because nothing gets done
True.
If we don't give it at least a decade, if not multiple decades.
Got it. And what's the vision for Plaksha, Neeraj? When you say reimagine, could you give us a sense of in what ways are you sort of reimagining technology education? Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I think we are reimagining on multiple aspects. One, a lot of magic happened at the intersection of disciplines. So, you know, more interdisciplinary. So most of the majors at Plaksha. So one is, for example, robotics and autonomous systems, which is at the intersection of computing, electronics and mechanical engineering. One is biosystem engineering, which is at the intersection of biology and computer science. One is data science, business and economics. So we have a global academic advisory board, which is some of the best and the brightest minds in the world. And we felt the magic happened at the intersection. And because we were greenfield,
we didn't have the legacy of any department. We don't have a chemistry department, a physics department, a math. So most of the, if you go to any top university in the world, you'll have one building, which is one department in the building. And oftentimes these departments over a period of time become silos and they don't interact. I mean, they're excellent in themselves, but the intersections are, have to be forced along, you know. So we said we will build that from day zero, right? The second innovation was, back to the point about technology is a big unlock. We said we will focus on a few sustainable development goals in India and focus our research from the early days on those. So we picked four. We said four is a good number. One is clean energy, but not at the big level of green hydrogen and fuel cells and all those, but, you know, more grounded things like smart district cooling, you know, cool roof, things which people can implement on the ground at scale.
Interesting.
Precision agriculture, so that, you know, think of the next technology initiating the next green revolution equivalent.
So this is out of grassroots innovation.
Grassroots innovation, clean water, a lot of water contamination. And the fourth one was personalized and equitable healthcare. So we said we will focus a lot of undergraduate research also on those. And we will stay with these over a long period of time because we felt India could create at-scale models for at least the global south to emulate, if not the world to emulate. Right, so those were way, and then we imagine all part of the value chain. How do we select students? What under? So, for example, one more thing, we have a freshman curriculum. So it's 3 terms, 18 months. Nobody has to choose their major getting in. After 18 months, this is nobody has done this in India. After 18 months, you choose your major.
Interesting.
And the courses in the freshman curriculum range from nature's machines. So it's not physics 101, physics 102, or applied maths 101. It's about So nature's machine, for example, is the course we're saying grasshopper is a machine. Applied machine. So what can you learn from that? So not every course is of that exotic a nature, but we've spent a lot of time reimagining the coursework itself. So I can go on and on, but you get the flavor.
But is there a benchmark in the West or another part of the world that, or is this really one of a kind?
No, this is one of a kind. Wow. And hence it has been, we are doing and learning. We are making some mistakes as well, I would be honest to say. And we are re-evaluating and learning and going forward.
And you've, in a way, you've had an opportunity to see what it takes to be effective as a leader in this context versus, let's say, BCG context versus the clients you serve. What have you learned about, let's say, leading a group of people in a such a mission-driven organization like Plaksha? In what ways has it shaped you as a person?
I think some facets have been similar. I was just reflecting, you know, tough question. Some have been harder or some have been different. Let's not say harder. The similar facets are a larger cause, which you're all drawn towards, and the ability to connect the dots. I think that's been, I talked about both these. I think the academics look at the world in a particular way. A startup CEO looks at the world in a particular way. A private equity CEO looks at the world in a particular way. A startup CEO. So, you know, but how do you see the commonality and the differences and connecting the dots? Those two have remained the same. But I think what I've learned also is that everybody comes in and out. We have a collective model. So running a partnership has been a great skill because we have 100 plus founders. They're all incredibly accomplished in their own world, in Plaksha. Yeah. Incredibly accomplished. Some of the best in their professions. But they all come in and out and they have deep beliefs in when they come in and out. So what do you listen to and what do you, you know, listen to but reject and what do you listen to and retain has sometimes been, you know, hard. It's not been the easiest because they come with good intent.
Correct.
But everything is not always right in that very moment. It may be right over a long sequence of time.
Right.
So that has been, it has pushed the degrees of learning to the next level. It has also given me more patience than my job taught me. And it has also, but it also provided a newfound appreciation for the world of academia as well. I think they have a very different playbook, but a very remarkably lovely playbook as well. But also some frustration with that world as well.
One of the things that stayed with me, Neeraj, if I may bring in this, when I spoke to Nandan Neelakini on the podcast, I asked him, you know, what does it take to make this co-founder relationship work in the context of Infosys? And he said something very interesting. He said, one is, of course, complementarity of skills, similarity of values.
The third he said was interesting. He said alignment on the duration for which you're playing the game. You know, someone might be playing a 10-year game, somebody might be playing a 50-year game, and the way you make trade-offs is very different.
So that time axis has a challenge because, look, funds are hard, right, to raise. So how do you make an operating break-even happen faster so that you're only putting money for doing the new stuff and not doing an operating bleed versus staying true, pure to the vision? And how do you straddle that has been a hard act. Because if you look at, you know, most of the universities in India, they have large donors, particularly the government of India. And if you look, tore apart their economic model, the economic model is actually badly broken. So creating a new playbook is hard in that context.
Building a world-class institution is never easy. If this topic is of interest, you might like my conversation with Ashish Dhawan at the podcast. In our conversation, he speaks about the vision behind Ashoka University. At playtopotential.com, you will also have stories of many people who found a way of contributing given their unique skill set and resources. Go to playtopotential.com and look up the curated playlist section for social impact. Let's get back to the conversation with Neeraj now. Neeraj, we could keep going. Mindful of time. So why don't I shoot some quick questions to you as we move towards wrapping up this conversation. One is just clearly you've sort of been very intentional about personal growth. What's been your, if you had to sort of distill your approach to personal growth and self-development, what would you say?
I think I look at life in, 10-year phases in some sense. I feel a lot gets done in 10 years. 2 to 3 years is too short. So I feel my first phase of about 15, 16 is when I set in my mind to become an engineer. Until about, for a decade, I was in that pursuit. And I think at that stage, I felt I became good at it. I mean, I was solving some of the tough technical problems at Cadence, and I was getting a lot of joy out of that. Then, as I told you about my switch, I wanted to be a good business person and a good consultant. So I think the next decade was getting the toolkit at IMA and then learning and applying that at BCG. The decade after that for me was a lot about, you know, now I have learned the toolkit, but I want to inspire the next generation of people. So taking some junior partners in my pyramid, going after some of the most bold and ambitious clients, winning in the market, you know, just that kind of a toolkit. And along with that, I was very actively involved with the work at Aadhaar. So also being, you know, kind of thoughtful about giving back even in those days. And then was a journey of the last decade, which was about leadership in BCG, but equally about giving time to something beyond the leadership at BCG to make a foundational difference, which was Plaksha. So I've done this in a fact. I can look back and give you a decade. I don't think I had a plan like a decade now. It's nice to think like that. But I think therein lies a little bit of a template, if I could, you know. To become excellent at something takes time. We sometimes, you know, and I would, Bill Gates, I think, said it's you overestimate what can happen in 2 years and underestimate what can happen in 10 years. I think those are profound words.
True.
You can say that about technology. You can say that about what we can accomplish in life. I met Abhiraj Bal yesterday, who's UrbanCo CEO, and he used to work with me at BCG and is there they're soon hopefully going to do an IPO is what they're planning. And he started 10 years ago, and it was a very unstructured industry. To create what they've created in a decade is remarkable. So I just quote that example outside, but to say that's a very good marker to take. So I would say, you know, people have many 10-year chapters to play in their life. That can be one template I can leave you with. But in that, then go all in. I don't think, you know, that's the other thing I would say. Then really be excellent at what you're doing. Then go all in is important. I don't know if that...
No, absolutely. I think I'm sort of, as you're reflecting, one of my conversations at the podcast was with Tarun Khanna of Harvard. And he's written a lovely book called Leadership to Last, where he's profiled people who built institutions to last. And one of the questions, and this is specifically in emerging economies. So I asked him, what is it about these leaders that stands out for you? And he said three things. One is audacity of intent. Second is humility of demeanor. Third is steadfastness of purpose.
And sort of as I listen to you, somehow I see a living version of those three coming to life. So it's deeply inspiring to hear you talk about all three and sort of the humility in the way you come across. No,
that's very kind of you and big of you to say
genuinely.
That.
Genuinely. And we are talking about building things to last, right? Whether it's BCG or whether it's Plaksha. So clearly, you know, it's wonderful.
And then if I may just add, while you're in that phase, learn from the best. Don't hold yourself back. Like, you know, so if you, whatever you want to be, right? I mean, if you want to be a photographer, then learn, want to be the best. If you want to be a gymnast, to be that or whatever the case may be.
Just changing lens, Neeraj. If you had to pass on three principles of living a good life to your kids, what would you say?
Wow, that's... I may take some pauses to reflect. Yeah, I think one I'm very clear about. Respect your elders who've seen more and respect the less privileged who live with less. I think both are very important. And to me, that's just one point. I think somehow I got that early in my growing up years. So I always feel that has held me the best. If there's even one value I can pass on, I would just stop at that. You know, second, I would say learn math, learn English and learn history. I mean, I think to me, what I meant by that was English is just a metaphor for language.
Yeah.
I think was not, I think,
not to be taken literally.
You know, not to be taken literally. I think those, the combination of that just is a powerful skill set. And I think, just reflecting, you know, because it's three things. And I feel ego is a big killer, right? I mean, I just feel so the anti-ego is humility or whatever it is. Just never feel entitled. You know, I think your life gives you more than you deserve, I think, as opposed to less than you deserve. Everybody feels you got less than they deserved. I feel, you know, feel happy with what you got and, you know, aspire big. So keep your eyes on the sky, but the nose on the ground, if I may just say it that way. Yeah.
Lovely.
Sorry, it came out, whatever
no,
it came
no,
out.
That's just beautiful. I think this podcast, Neeraj, is titled Play to Potential. You know, this is a question I ask everybody who's been on the podcast. What does the phrase play to potential mean to you?
I think, firstly, it's an incredibly good phrase. I don't say this to any... I genuinely think perform to potential or play to potential. Most people I meet, I say there is a performance potential gap that I see in you and your potential is actualize your potential. So I feel everybody has immense potential and life, back to my 20% shift on the leadership curve was about narrowing the performance potential gap. And it comes from both, most of us, like Buddha said, most of the answers lie within. A lot lies within. And so people don't take the time to, you know, our life experiences teaches us a lot. But equally, finding enough role models outside, which are outside as well. So I think to me, both performance and potential or play to potential is about realizing, having the belief that you have immense potential, but also not signing up for something which is not audacious enough. I think it's just that's... somewhat rambling, but that just is.
But on that note, Neeraj, it's a real pleasure to meet a friend and to sort of do this. And I've been deeply inspired by your journey as a leader and as a person. And thank you for making the time to share your wisdom with us.
And I must return, I think what you have done in this podcast genuinely is, I shared this with all my colleagues in Asia, saying, and I shared only three podcasts and this was one of them this is my top one. And I deeply believe that the wisdom you're creating is eternal and holds and outlasts the world of AI and outlasts the world of everything. So thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you, Neeraj. I hope you found the conversation as inspiring as I did. To dig into our work, consider visiting playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Members can access curated insights by theme. If you are a CEO or a CHRO of a company, you might find that this piece is useful in the context of sharing resources with people in line with their development needs. You might also find the book Play to Potential, published by Penguin Relevant, if you're curious about leading a full life
amidst the constraints and the pulls and pressures of midlife. Thank you for listening, and look forward to having you tune into the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.